So I want to introduce my friend to you who grew up in a part of the country where you could see a sunrise and sunset almost every day, and who now lives in a place in the world where you almost never see it. He lives in a place that was flat, and now lives in a place where the skyline goes like this. I thought maybe I would introduce him as the 5G guy. First, he's a real gentleman. All right. He said I should just tell you the truth, that's all. So this is the truth, the plain truth, but not all of it. So he's a real gentleman, and second, gee, he's generous. He's been my tech support guy for a long time. I'm very grateful, thank you. The next G is he's kind of a geek, too. So, okay. But he's also very generous and has welcomed maybe at least one or more children into his life, into their lives, not their own biological children. But how can I get to the other G's so he's a 5G guy? Well, he's growing from glory to glory, so I thought that would fill it in. But the last thing is, he's a pioneer. And so he's living as a church planter, trying to communicate the gospel to a wide variety of people. He lives in the city of our country that is the most culturally diverse. He lives in the part of the city that's most culturally diverse. A neighbor to a hospital where they hire about 150 translators for 150 languages, give or take. So that's Josh. I'm proud of you, Josh. And I'm grateful to count you a friend of mine and a co-worker's. Let's pray. Father in heaven, I thank you for Josh, who is a generous gentleman growing from glory to glory, gathering in the lost and the left behind, and working with you to establish a church in Jackson Heights, Queens, New York City. As he talks to us this morning about communicating the gospel to secular people, I pray you'll empower him with your spirit. Help him to know what to include, what to leave out, how to share what you've placed in his heart and mind to share with us. I pray you'll help all of us to be very receptive and thoughtful as he speaks on your behalf and on behalf of the unreached, the unchurched, and the secular to us this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you, Alan. You are also very generous. So on July 16, 1945, something happened that changed the course of history. At a remote location in New Mexico, scientists exploded the first nuclear weapon. It's called the Trinity Test. And since then, things have never been the same. Humanity is now capable of wiping itself out. Entire cities with millions of people can be annihilated with a single explosion. The stakes of any war have been raised higher than they've ever been. And I would suggest that we are closer than we have ever been to complete annihilation since the flood. Society has been fundamentally changed. And I think changed so deeply that unless we lived before 1945, we can't actually wrap our mind around how just how different it is. And there's no going back. Nuclear weapons are here, and they're here to stay. And to think that one can completely eliminate them is a fool's errand. To plan a war pretending that nuclear weapons didn't exist would be the height of folly. I would like to suggest that something similar has happened in the West regarding faith. That the introduction of doubt and the introduction of doubt in God has fundamentally changed things. And that to go about evangelism as if it hasn't changed is also the height of folly. And there's no going back. There's no putting the genie back in the bottle. I think everything is different now. You know, there was a time when the West was Christianized. Richard Fletcher, in his book, The Barbarian Conversion, describes how Christianity in the Middle Ages spread into Europe, first into the cities and then to the countryside, until all of Europe was Christianized. And in that context, you could even say 300 or 400 years ago, there was a lot you could take it for granted. Concepts of a universal truth, concepts of an absolute right and wrong, concepts of sin or of a universal religion. You may take those for granted, kind of, now, but those are uniquely Christian concepts. And your goal or your job as an evangelist was basically to prod people, to say, you know you're supposed to be a good person, and you know you're not, and let me introduce you to the one who can be your goodness, Jesus. And further, people basically kind of knew what you were going to say. They kind of knew what the problem was, and they kind of knew what the solution was, and they just needed prodding. There was very little difference between evangelism and revival. And if you went to church and you were religious, people viewed that positively. They might not be willing to do it themselves, but you were kind of seen as a good person. And so evangelism was almost like being a salesman for a high-end car dealership. Like, people might not want to be willing to pay the price, but they could see that what you were offering was something that was worth having, right? It's not like that anymore. Those days are coming to an end. I'm speaking out of experience in New York, and you might say your experience is different, but here's the deal. Culture always flows from cities out to the countryside. It's always been that way. And so if you want to see what the Midwest or Pennsylvania is going to look like 20 years from now, or 30 years from now, you need to look to New York and LA, because that's what it's going to look like. And in that context, Christianity has moved from something that people maybe view as a good thing but can't be bothered to do, to something that is actively dangerous and evil. It's like you went from being the Ferrari salesman to being the local drug dealer. And in the last few decades, I think especially people, average people, not philosophers, but average people, have been building coherent worldviews that do not include a God. And you might say, well, look, the cities, they're always evil. But here's the deal. Cities actually aren't inherently evil. All right, cities are just on the leading edge of culture. So they're just where culture, where society is headed. We'll talk about this more later, but Christianity actually spread like wildfire through the cities. It was almost entirely an urban religion for the first couple hundred years. So I want to talk about how we got here to where we're at now. I want to talk about some things that aren't going to work in evangelism. I want to talk about some things that might work. And I would give us a few practical suggestions. All right, how we got here, what's not going to work, what might work, and some suggestions. So I apologize. This is going to have to be a very brief overview of how we got to now. It's going to leave things out. But interestingly, in his book, A Secular Age, Charles Taylor, who is a believer, suggests that it was actually the Protestant Reformation that laid the seeds that led to atheism. So in the Middle Ages, Christianity spread through Europe. It was mostly in the cities, started spreading out in the countryside. But, like I said, it didn't matter. You might be Catholic, you might be Protestant, but either way, you were Christian. It was just assumed. There was no... God was as given as gravity. The idea that there might not be a God was like suggesting that the earth is flat. And that's almost impossible for us to imagine, I think. But that's because we've been influenced by doubt. But something started happening. I think the Enlightenment definitely started influencing it. But in the 16th and the 17th centuries, the view of God shifted from someone who we serve, who we answer to someone who is there for the good of humanity. And that might seem, it's true, God cares about our good, but the tone shifted from being one where we answer to God to one in which he is here to serve us. And the concept of God as a distant watchmaker who set the universe in motion and has basically let it go came to the fore. But what I think is the most telling is what the apologetics looked like during this time. During the 18th century, the tone shifted. And it shifted from arguing that Christianity is true to arguing that Christianity is reasonable. And by doing so, I was amused because we have a book, Reasonable Faith. I'm not saying there's not room for apologetics, we'll talk about that. But what happened is the tone shifted, and it shifted from this is truth to you should be willing to entertain this because it is reasonable. Do you understand the difference? So we have put reason in the driver's seat now, and the text has to answer to reason rather than the other way around. And so we got to a place, and Kyle Susan, I thought, did a great job of this in his breakout session, where we came to view science and the secular as being unbiased, and religion or Christianity as being biased or inferior. Leslie Newbegin, in his book, The Gospel in a Pluralist Society, described it as this: is we got to the point where doubt becomes more honest than faith, which he describes as an entirely irrational prejudice. So now we got to the point where we didn't need faith anymore. What we did is we, if you were going to be intellectually honest, is you started doubting everything, and then you sought to see if Christianity might be reasonable to you. So we don't need faith. But how did it get to be actually dangerous? There are many reasons, but I would suggest that in the American context, it was because of our obsession with freedom. So the American experiment, if you will, took the Christian ideal of individual choice, of personal freedom, and took it to and beyond its logical extreme. And so now Christianity is actually something that constrains that freedom, that places limits on it. There are things that are not appropriate to do that you may not do if you're following Jesus, and that makes it dangerous. And lest we point fingers too much, this has, I think, deeply influenced the church. And I won't push the point too much, but I would just observe in the last 18 months, the number of times I've heard about my rights, that is an indication of how much individualism and self-centeredness has influenced the church. But here's the thing. We are still riding on the currents of Christianity. We're riding on fumes, but we're riding on the fumes of Christianity in that our underlying value system is still Christianized. The secular humanists that I talk to care deeply about caring for the poor. They care deeply about universal human rights. And you know, if I'm honest, many of them, or some of them, live that out better than some people I see going to church. So we're now in a world where Christianity is considered dangerous, and yet our very values at the bedrock of our belief come from Christianity. Universal human rights and caring for the poor are deeply and uniquely Christian concepts. So I'm reminded of the verse, I think this is 2 Timothy, having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. I think we're coasting on momentum, personally. So, we are now changed. Taylor says this, even as faith endures in our secular age, believing doesn't come easy. Faith is fraught. Confession is haunted by an inescapable sense of its contestability. We don't believe instead of doubting. We believe while doubting. We're all Thomas now. We believe while doubting. So that's how we got to now. So here are a few things that I think are not going to work. The way we've done evangelism for the last 100 years. The four spiritual laws, here's the truth. If you've done bad things, Jesus is a bridge to God, go for it. It depends on so many of the Christian credibility structures. Is there right and wrong? No one told me that. Why are you trying to tell me what to do? Why are you trying to make me feel guilty? Also, I would suggest that trying to defend Christianity in evangelism, trying to convince people that Christianity is reasonable and that therefore they ought to believe in it, is a mistake. Because again, you're making reason the gatekeeper. Now, I'm not arguing against apologetics. Hear me out. Once someone wants to believe the gospel, but they call them defeaters, I think there's a huge role for apologetics. But here's the deal. Contemporary people think of true as being, it works for me. Tim Keller talks about the early days of Redeemer Presbyterian, a church that he planted in Manhattan. He was just bewildered when people came in and they got the truth of the gospel, and then they found a partner who wasn't a Christian and they just left. And he was just baffled. They believed that Christianity was true. So he realized that when he said true, they heard, this will work for you. And so they took it until it didn't work for them anymore. But also, I think there's an aspect in which the gospel isn't reasonable. It's offensive. It's deeply offensive. It will offend every culture in different ways. And I would just say on a personal note, if the gospel has not offended you, you haven't interacted with it deeply enough. The gospel is going to turn your life upside down. Another thing that isn't going to work is hit and run, as I call them, gospel presentations. Have a flyer, see you on Sunday. Now, we hand out flyers, but we hand them out as a way to start a conversation. And at the risk of getting myself in trouble, I would suggest that VBS programs without incarnational follow-up do more harm than good. They inoculate people with the gospel by giving them little, like, four-year-old versions of Bible stories so that when they actually hear the real thing as an adult, they connect it with that silly story they heard about a big fish that swallowed somebody. Lastly, and I say this delicately, but fear is not going to work. So I see signs that say, where are you going to spend eternity? Or talk about hell. And I was trying to come up with it. The best way I know to describe this is an analogy. And to the modern New Yorker, hell is like Santa Claus. So if you saw a sign that said, you better behave yourself because Santa's coming to town, that's the kind of reaction that, maybe put some flames on it because people know you're serious. I'm not saying there aren't places for that and there aren't people for which that has an impact. But what I'm saying is that at least in urban centers, we have moved to a place where people not only don't want to believe in hell, but truly do not believe there is a hell. That there is no, like, nagging, what if that were right, in their minds? Fear isn't going to work. So here are a few suggestions about what might work. Go slow. In your evangelism, go slow. And what I mean by go slow is not what they call friendship evangelism. Friendship evangelism was this thing that we tried, I don't know, 20 years ago. And the idea was the gospel runs in the context of relationships. So if you want to share the gospel with someone, what you do first is you become their friend, and you befriend them, and you spend time with them. And then, like 6 months later, you share the gospel with them. And there's, like all mistakes, there's an element of truth there. But one, I mean, this is just from my personal experience. Once you've invested that much time in a person, you actually are less likely to share the gospel with them because you value their friendship and you're concerned that you will compromise your friendship by sharing the gospel, which you probably will. Because your whole friendship has been based on you being dishonest. You've been pursuing this person ostensibly just to become their friend, but really you have an ulterior motive the whole time. You just haven't been telling them about it. So that's not what I'm talking about. But I am talking about going slow. And what I mean by that is, it's in Supremacy of Christ in a Postmodern World. Tim Keller says there are four stages to someone accepting the gospel. There's intelligibility, there's credibility, there's plausibility, and there's intimacy. So intelligibility is saying, do I understand the gospel? Like, not do I deeply understand every nuance, but do I get the basic message? Like, the words that I'm hearing, do they actually mean what the speaker thinks they do? Credibility, can the gospel possibly be true? This is where we talked about objections or defeaters. These are beliefs that a person may hold that make believing in the gospel impossible. For example, if you truly believe that miracles are impossible, you can't believe the gospel. One of the things that the 18th century apologist said is actually twisted. They said, yeah, okay, we agree. Miracles can't happen. But when we talk about the resurrection, Jesus didn't actually literally rise from the dead. It was that the disciples had this psychological experience that they interpreted as Jesus rising from the dead. And you see what they're doing. They're allowing the gospel to be a subject to reason. This is not that, but this is saying there are beliefs that someone will hold that may make the gospel impossible to accept. You need to address those. And there's plausibility, and this is, do I want the gospel to be true? I know of one person that I've ever met that became a Christian because of logic. Most people I find come because they get to a point where they want the gospel to be true. Does the gospel speak to a deep yearning inside of me that I have? And then lastly, intimacy is, do I commit myself to the gospel? And our tendency when we do gospel presentations, when we share the gospel, is we skip steps 1 through 3 and go straight to 4. We assume that you know everything and you want it to be true because I want it to be true, and we go straight to 4. Would you like to accept Christ? And at best, you get rejected. But I would suggest what's even worse is you might get someone to accept the gospel and think that they're a Christian and not understand it and not actually be a believer. I think that's worse. And so you got to ask questions. When people say words like true, what do they mean? C.S. Lewis wrote a fantastic book called Studies in Words, where he explores how words have changed, specific words have changed in meaning over time. So when Shakespeare says something is physical, he doesn't actually mean flesh and blood. He means it's good for you. It's a completely different meaning than it does today. And he calls the meaning that we have today the dangerous sense, because he says, when you read ancient literature, you see this word and you say, physical, I know what physical means. But you don't. You don't understand what it means in that context. And I would suggest that the words that we use in gospel presentations are full of dangerous sense kinds of words. Words that don't mean what we think they do. You know, it's just, I was listening to a speaker in the last month or two, and he said, you know, based on what I've read and what I've seen in the Bible, guilt is emotional manipulation used by someone when they want to control you. Just like, that is like exactly what the Bible says guilt is not. Like, how can you say that? I talked about true, right? True is what works for me. So listen, and when people use words that don't assume that they mean what you think they do. So go slow. Secondly, listen. Listen to what they're saying. And ask questions, ask them why they believe what they do. Everyone has beliefs. Why do they believe what they do? And everyone, I have not met a single person that does not have some line that they believe should never be crossed. Usually it's universal human rights or care for the poor. I believe that all societies everywhere, most secular humanists would say, should take care of the poor. Why do you believe that? We'll talk about that in a little bit. Ask questions. But also because different people are at different places. So you may run into, say, a Hispanic person with a Catholic background, and they have a lot of those structures in place already. You don't need to go through steps 1 and 2. So you want to hear just where people are at. Everyone is coming from a different place. And again, because faith has become so fractured in contemporary culture, you just can't make the same assumptions that you used to be able to. I also suggest that if the church is going to be effective in winning the West, they are going to have to embrace justice and beauty. See, we've heard this, and it's just been fantastic, different speakers talking about the Bible is a set of truths, but it's also a deeply compelling story. It's a story that answers so many questions that we have about the Word, explains why things are the way they are. This was in the 40s. Scientists were discussing Einstein's theory of relativity. And there was no way to prove that the theory was true. And yet, it was so beautiful, is so beautiful and comprehensive and explains so many things about the way we view the world that scientists said, it has to be true. And ironically, Bertrand Russell, a famous atheist who wrote Why I Do Not Believe in God, I believe is the title, was days before the atomic bomb exploded, discussing this on a radio program, saying, you know, this theory will probably never have practical implications, but it's got to be true. It's so beautiful. Well, and then we blew people up with it. I would suggest that Christianity is like the theory of relativity. It's so comprehensive and so beautiful and so good at explaining the way the world is that it has to be true. And in his book, N.T. Wright writes Simply Christian. It's a fantastic book. From my perspective, it is Mere Christianity for the 21st Century. He talks about signposts in the mist. These are things in Christianity that are not proof that Christianity is true, but they point us in that direction. Like, they answer things. And one of them that he talks about is a desire for justice. In each of us, we have this deep desire for things to be just, and yet so often injustice is the result. He says that's a signpost that's supposed to point us to Christianity. And I would just suggest to you that if the church is going to win the West, it's going to have to love justice. And it's going to have to be upset at injustice. We're going to have to care for the poor. We're going to have to speak up for the marginalized. Justice and systemic justice is a core part of the gospel story, the whole story of the Bible, from Deuteronomy, include the poor and the marginalized in your feasts, to the prophets, you're neglecting the poor, to Jesus, I have come to set the captives free, to the early church. Paul said when he was getting his gospel checked out with the other apostles, they just said, make sure you remember the poor. To the early church, post-Acts, there's this great line where an emperor says, the trouble with these Christians who he hated is that they not only take care of their own poor, but ours as well. It's a core part of the gospel. And what happened, from my perspective, is in the early 20th century, the church split, and there was what was called the social justice movement. It said, we want to take care of justice, but they neglected small things like sin and the fall and redemption and the gospel. And that was bad, just saying. But what was also bad is there was a reaction to that that said, all that stuff must be bad. We're going to focus on people's souls. And in doing so, I'm not saying the intention was evil, but that also leaves out a part of the gospel. And more recently, especially in the last couple years, the attempts by conservative Christians and conservative Anabaptists to smear the legacy of the civil rights movement that was born out of the black church is not Christ-like. And then we wonder why our churches are so white. I mean, how could it be? And when the secular world sees a group of people that says we're pro-life, but we're not going to help the poor, we're not going to speak up for the marginalized, they say, I don't want anything to do with that. Because here's the thing that just breaks my heart, is this is one of the few places where secular humanists and the gospel are in complete agreement. Overwhelmingly, the secular humanists that I talk to care about the poor deeply. They care about human rights. And when we neglect those core aspects of the gospel, we lose a tremendous amount of credibility. So back to Simply Christian, Wright says, another one of the signposts in the mist is the yearning for beauty. We long for beauty, and yet it's so fleeting. And you know, there is something about art, music, that evokes this deep spiritual component inside of us. That has no secular explanation. That serves, if you believe in natural selection, that serves no purpose in natural selection. There's no reason for it to be there. Julian Barnes, who's an agnostic, wrote this book called Nothing to be Frightened Of, and he starts out the book by saying, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. And he says this, missing God is focused for me by missing the underlying sense of purpose and belief when confronted with religious art. It is one of the haunting hypotheticals for the non-believer. What would it be like if it were true? And you know, there's something about listening to a Mozart concert, and you feel these feelings of beauty and spirituality inside welling up. And it is entirely uncompelling to say, you know, those are merely chemical impulses in my brain that somehow were part of my ancestors trying to survive as a human race. It just doesn't make sense. And so I would suggest that the church is going to need to embrace art and beauty to speak to a secular age. And in fact, perhaps the reason that we focus so much on the axiomatic truths of the gospel and less on the story is because we've actually been influenced by the modern scientific focus with its focus on precision. The Bible is a compelling story. And when we talk about these things and we're trying to build bridges, I want to just harp on the fact this is not the same thing that we tried in the 18th century. There we said, we are going to distort the gospel, distort the story of the Bible to fit your criteria. What this is saying is, you have these deep longings. Let me show you a gospel that it's offensive, but it answers those deep longings you have better than the faith that you have right now does. It answers that deep part inside of you. It's what you're looking for. So, some practical suggestions. Be humble. I did say practical, and I did not say easy. But I think it is easy for us, perhaps because we have so little interaction with people that have zero belief in God, to create stereotypes and communicate stereotypes of them that are not accurate or helpful. They're pagans, or they're sinful, they're just wanting to be promiscuous, they're hateful. That actually doesn't match up with my experience of these people. So I don't think it's true. I think it's going to be very difficult to win the West if that's the attitude that we have. But also, don't be intimidated. We have the gospel, guys. This is the power to save people. Don't be feel defensive when you don't have an immediate answer for something that someone raises. We're not God. We're just messengers, all right? Like, there are, as Leslie Newbegin says, there are places to be agnostic, to say, I don't know, and let me find out. All right? Don't be intimidated. One thing I do think you'll run into, maybe more than anything else, is this persistent belief that what we have is faith and bias, and what they have is truth and science and fact. I mean, you might have heard this, like, all religions have part of the truth, right? And you've seen, like, the analogy of the story with the blind man and the elephant. Have you heard that story? Like, the blind man go up to the elephant, and some people feel the legs, and it's like, the elephant is a tree, and then someone else thinks gets aside, and it's like, it's a wall. And so the line goes, religions are like that. You know, they all see a little part of the truth, but they don't see everything. It is impossible to understand the whole truth. But you understand the fallacy with that. That story of the blind man and the elephant is being told by a seeing person who can actually see all of reality. And so you can't make a claim that all religions are part of the truth unless you yourself have absolute truth. The very thing that you said doesn't exist and one can't have. It's a leap of faith to say that. But also, and this is one of my favorite things to talk with people about, those values. Where do you get them from? As someone said, we got to where we are by the strong, eating the weak, through natural selection, through evolution, and now let us all love each other. It just doesn't make sense. Friedrich Nietzsche was a German philosopher, late 19th century. He's the guy that said, God is dead and we have killed him. Didn't believe in God. But he said this, and because of this, he has been called the ghost at the atheist feast. It's a great line. He says, without Christianity, there is no universal human rights. There is no care for the poor. There is only a will to power. And this is out of Twilight of the Idols. He says this, when one gives up the Christian faith, one pulls the right to Christian morality out from under one's feet. This morality is by no means self-evident. Christianity is a system, a whole view of things thought out together. By breaking one main concept of it, the faith in God, one breaks the whole. By Christian morality is a command. Its origin is transcendent. It is beyond all criticism, all right to intuitively know what is good and evil. When they therefore suppose that they no longer require Christianity as the guarantee of morality, we merely witness, and listen to this, we merely witness the effects of the dominion of the Christian value judgment and an expression of the strength and depth of this dominion, such that the origin of English morality has been forgotten. You hear what he's saying? This is an agnostic, and he's saying, All the stuff that you believe about loving each other, about caring for the poor, speaking up for the marginalized, that came from Christianity. And if you reject Christianity, you have to get rid of that too. So why do you believe what you do? Really, why? Like, I can explain why I do. Like, why do you think that not just you, but everyone ought to love each other, that everyone ought to speak up for the poor? That doesn't help natural selection. Speak to the heart, and that's what I talked about. Identify these longings that people have and explain how the gospel speaks to them. We're going to talk about this more in the Bible Studies workshop. And lastly, seriously consider an urban orientation. This means move to the city. And I don't mean on a 3-day mission trip. As someone has said, and I quote, "The cities are places where there are more people than plants, and the countryside is the place where there are more plants than people. Since God loves people far more than plants, he must love the city more than the countryside." It's deadly serious. I'm not joking. And look, cities are where culture is formed and where society is headed. And in the 20th century, conservative Christianity abandoned the cities, and now we're shocked at where society is going. Like, what were we thinking? What did we think was going to happen? Sitting at the countryside and complaining about where culture is headed is like sitting in a stream that's polluted by a factory upstream and trying to frantically clean it up and complain about where all this pollution is coming from. You can work as hard as you want, but you're not getting to the source. Like, imagine, and look at the Bible. Where did Jonah go? He went to Assyria, the capital, Nineveh. Where did Paul go? He went to the cities. Where did Jesus go? He went to the countryside, but he also spent a lot of time in Jerusalem. Where did the prophets go? Jerusalem. It's always the cities. Like, what would it be like if the people that are influencing the direction that culture shifts would find themselves rubbing shoulders with people, not that have some empty form of Christianity that doesn't actually affect what they do, and is easy to mock, but these people that work together and live together, and they're very strange, and the things they believe are offensive, but there's something there. I'm not sure what, but something is there. How would society be different? So, if there's one thing I can leave you with, it's this. There's no going back. There's no going back to an age when there was no doubt. The way things were 200 years ago, or even 40 years ago. But I don't think that's all bad. I think there's an upside. I think this gives the church an opportunity to seriously wrestle with, what is the gospel actually about? When everyone was basically Christian and we were just prodding them, we could get away with a faith that was shallow. Because everyone, you weren't going to get pushback. You might get apathy, but you weren't going to get pushback. Now, in the age of pushback, we have to actually wrestle with, what is the gospel actually? What does it mean? What is the central story? Why is it compelling? Why should someone take it after all? I think that this gives the church a unique opportunity for revival. And I am excited to live in this moment. You know, often when I go to conferences, New York is a separate planet. I don't know. It's just so different than Lancaster County. But often I go to these conferences, I hear people talking, like, how do we keep our youth? All the bright ones, all the ones with vision seem to leave. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes I hear it combined with a vision where what we need to do is maintain what we've got and circle the wagons more, because obviously somehow doubt is getting in, and above all, avoid change that could be a mistake. I don't think I could come up with a less compelling vision, honestly, folks. What if instead we had a church that was on mission? A church that was going somewhere that said, we are going to reach out to the poor so much that, like the emperors of Rome, people will notice. Even if they don't like us, people will notice. What if we speak up for the marginalized in a way that communicates that we actually care about them and we're willing to do something about it? And we integrate them into our churches with all the mess. And above all, we aggressively share the gospel. And if people don't come to our churches, we ask why. What's wrong? What are we doing wrong? And we change. Not to corrupt the gospel, but to let the gospel and all of its offensive beauty come through. And we kept working at it until we got it right. And what if we said, as a church, we are going to storm the very gates of hell? If you do that, you will run into problems. But maintaining or keeping youth with a vision will not be one of them. You'll be misunderstood. The church down the street, who previously you mostly differed on a few rules, they will think you have lost your marbles. But keeping youth will not be a problem. I'm excited about the gospel, folks. That's what empowered Paul in the early church. And you know, the Greco-Roman world was the pinnacle of civilization of its time. And I would suggest maybe hasn't been surpassed since. The Greek philosophers, someone has said that all modern philosophy is footnotes on Plato. That's an exaggeration, but you understand the point. These were the sharpest minds of the time, and I would say probably the most impressive and sophisticated and cultured civilization that had ever been. And yet, through that, Christianity spread like wildfire. In 300 years, it went from being pagan with deeply unchristian values to being almost entirely Christianized. What happened? Could it be that the gospel actually changes people? Huh. And I'll say that if we continue with the status quo, spiritual decline in the West is almost a given. But it does not have to be this way. I want to see the gospel capture the heart of the West again. Thank you.
Wow, thank you, Josh. What you said right there at the end, if we continue with the status quo, spiritual decline within the West is a given, but it does not have to be this way. Thank you for the practical ways that you've given us here today to think about, to start mulling about how can we make these changes, how can we stop it from being this way within our churches, and I hope that these conversations can continue on today in your breakouts, in your small groups. With Josh, if you get a chance to talk with him either at his breakout or at lunch or after and with each other, let's take this vision and the passion of this, of wanting to see our churches be radical places of showing Jesus' love in our communities and transforming them. And let's keep this conversation going.